The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 9. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Finn McCool, Dale Thompson, Dominic Eagle, and Micah Edwards. Tonight, we will hear stories of angry appetites, slinking slaughter, distressing duplicates, and dangerous deception. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. They are our friends, companions, helpers, and otherwise just pets. They can also be waiting for just the right moment to drag us to the basement and take over as kings of the earth. Yes, that grin on your fuzzy friend's face could be just a ruse, a cunning attempt to lure you into safety before committing unspeakable acts of violence. And tonight, we honor that dedication to our eventual usurpation with four stories of animals that know when they've had the upper hand. Finn McCool begins the evening with a confession of a man with a very peculiar series of jobs and recalls his time of employment with a fellow of decidedly ill repute. But it's not so much the employer that needs to be worried about. His new companion, well, that just loves inviting everyone to dinner, so to speak. Shall we take a peek and see what he has to tell us? Without further ado, I present to you Diablo, the Man-Eater. I stood under the baking hot sun, sweating profusely, as I tried in vain to swat away the mosquitoes that bit into my burnt skin. I held a tight hold of my AK-47 as I stared down at the pile of butchered human bodies, their rotting flesh already starting to stink in the midday tropical heat. I tried my best not to retch, knowing that my sadistic employer and his lieutenants would not appreciate the distraction from the ritualistic feeding of his favorite pet. I was standing alongside my fellow mercenaries, soldiers of fortune with no moral qualms, willing to commit just about any atrocity imaginable as long as the price was right.
I'd like to claim I wasn't like the others. I'd once considered myself a man of honor, a soldier with a code and lines I would not cross. But by this point in my career, I was a shadow of my former self, more a butcher than a warrior. And so I stood with the others, a platoon of the damned looking down upon our own bloody handiwork. Before us was a pile of 7 corpses, local tribesmen who were unfortunate enough to fall into our hands. Our orders were to escort the prisoners back to the base, not revealing until the last moment that it was our intention to kill them. Our employer preferred it this way, insisting that Diablo liked his meat fresh. The unsuspecting prisoners were promptly machine-gunned down as they stood at the pit's edge, their eyes widening in terror once they saw us raise our rifles to aim and fire. A barrage of bullets cut them down while the creature in the pit below splashed wildly through the shallow water, clearly excited at the prospect of the meal to come. Our employer arrived not long after in a chauffeur-driven limousine, the long black vehicle kicking up the dry earth as it came. The tyrant appeared resplendent in his smart dress uniform, pinned with a half dozen self-awarded medals of silver and gold, and he marched with his typical arrogant confidence, swaggering towards the pit with his vigilant bodyguards in tow. The men barely acknowledged our respectful salutes as they walked past us, so focused as they were on their mission. The tyrant also ignored the foul stench of death, a smell that was all too familiar to him as he casually observed the bodies we delivered. I saw the disappointment in his dark eyes and flinched, fearing we would soon see one of our employer's characteristic violent tirades. But on this odd afternoon, he was surprisingly composed, taking hold of his fine ivory walking stick as he poked at the emaciated and bloodied bodies beneath his feet. He tutted before speaking in a crisp English accent, a product of his elite education at Oxford, paid for by his late father. "Oh dear, such pathetic offerings, so scrawny and lacking in decent mate. My beauty deserves much better, but needs must." The beauty he referred to was the greedy predator, now splashing fanatically at the bottom of the pit, a smell of blood in his nostrils. The tyrant turned toward us, casting me a chilling glare with his killer's eyes. I couldn't meet his gaze, but did respond to his bellowed orders. "You two, commence the feeding." I nodded to the man on my right, a burly South African mercenary called Jan, and two of us, well, we reluctantly walked forward besides the bodies. We grabbed hold of the first corpse, Jan taking the arms and me the legs. Working together, we dragged the dead man over the edge to the pit, swinging him back and forth several times before we pitched the body downwards. I glanced over the edge in time to see the corpse tumbling down the muddy slope before landing heavily in the murky green water, producing a mighty splash as it did so. The huge and scaled reptilian predator who dwelt down there didn't stand on ceremony. It had grown fat on human flesh over the years, but was always hungry for more. Cutting through the water, the beast grabbed hold of the dead man within its mighty jaws, biting deep as it enacted a death toll, not strictly necessary, given that its prey was already dead, but instinct was a hard thing to brush off. It repeated this routine several times over before biting down even harder, literally splitting the human body in two. With this grim task complete, the beast eagerly chomped down on human flesh, cracking bones in his maw and filling the murky water with dark blood. It was a sickening sight, but worse yet was the cold stare from the beast's soulless eyes as it silently demanded its next offering. Jan and I went to work, taking hold of the next body and preparing to throw it down to the beast. I suppose these victims should count themselves lucky. At least they were dead before they went into the pit, because others had been fed to the beast while still alive. At the time of writing, I'm a wanted war criminal. The reason for my current status should be obvious, as I've described, just one of the many atrocities I participated in. For legal reasons, I will not reveal certain details, including my name, the exact locations of my crimes, or the identity of the bloodthirsty warlord who I once served. Suffice it to say, my career as a soldier of fortune led me from one war zone to the next until I eventually reached the killing fields of Central Africa. I was deployed to a province plagued by bloody civil war, as generations of tribal divisions and the interference of greedy Western powers and corporations resulted in a bloodbath all but ignored by the outside world. The tale is sadly familiar, and I'm certainly not the good guy in the story. Sure, there were worse than me in that war zone, pure sadists who enjoyed mass murder and savagery. I was there for the money for the most part, and my employer paid well, having made his fortunes through the ruthless exploration of the province's mineral wealth. This is no excuse for the evil acts I committed, and if there is a hell, I'm surely heading there. But this story isn't about me, it's about Diablo, the beast with unexplainable supernatural powers that stalks the rivers, lakes, and waterways of that forgotten land. Diablo is a 17-foot-long, 2,000-pound Nile crocodile who's developed an unfortunate taste for human flesh. He's terrifying and a deadly predator, and that would be frightening enough. But Diablo, or whatever his original name was, isn't merely a savage animal. Given all I've witnessed, I have to believe he's so much more. Diablo was given the name to the legendary beast by Spanish slave traders who arrived in the coastal regions during the 17th century. The slavers heard tales of a giant man-eating crocodile worshipped by the native tribes. However, Diablo goes by many names and has an even longer history, with legends claiming he's descended from Sobek, the ancient Egyptian deity with the body of a man and the head of a killer reptile. This would make the beast centuries or even thousands of years old, which of course would be impossible for an ordinary Nile crocodile. I therefore assumed that there had been multiple Diablos over time, with a legend attached to any man-eating croc inhabiting the region. I'm not so sure now, however. By the time I found my way to that backwater province, Diablo was under the care of my former employer, though a savage warlord I'd previously described. The warlord in question was half-crazed, believing that his power, wealth, and military success were all down to the killer reptile and whatever dark magic Diablo was capable of conjuring. He was therefore determined to keep his most prized pet in captivity, feeding him fresh bodies to satisfy the beast's substantial appetite. The warlord's residence was a fortified former colonial residence situated several miles south of the mines he controlled and close to a tributary river. The aforementioned pit where we threw the bodies was a small body of water dammed off the river where Diablo had been trapped by the warlord. And the prey we regularly fed to Diablo were captured enemy fighters, at first at least. The foot soldiers were shot while the officers got fed to the beast while still living, their terrifying screams filling the air before Diablo dragged them under with his mighty jaws. I shouldn't have participated in these appalling crimes, but I feared what would happen to me if I disobeyed my employer, and so I reluctantly complied. And after a while, I began to wonder whether there was some truth to the warlord's crazed ramblings and bizarre beliefs. As the savage civil war dragged on, more and more bodies were tossed into the pit for Diablo to greedily feast upon, and simultaneously my employer enjoyed a string of successes in the jungle battlefields, vanquishing his enemies and capturing yet more mines, as his wealth and power grew to almost sickening proportions. The blood magic is a notoriously dangerous card to play, and men who make deals with the devil will usually live to regret it. The night before the massacre was marked by a torrential rain, and I had the misfortune of being out on patrol deep in the bush. My three-man squad consisted of me and two local trackers called Ease and Kato. We'd been tasked with hunting down a rebel column, but had come up empty-handed, returning to the base at dawn, exhausted, drenched, and very frustrated. I expected to receive a stern rebuke from our employer over the failure of our ambush mission, but as we approached the barbed wire perimeter, I instead heard the ominous rat-a-tat of machine gun fire. My comrades and I broke into a sprint as we readied our weapons. We thought our base was under attack, but the scene we discovered was far worse than I could have imagined. We entered through the gate and approached the pit, smelling the foul stench of death mixed with cordite, the gun smoke slowly clearing under the dawn sun to reveal a sickening massacre. I saw Jan manning a 50 caliber machine gun mounted to the rear of a pickup truck, the weapon's now empty barrel still smoking as he retained an ice-cold grip on the trigger. I glanced up into his killer's eyes and saw no trace of humanity left. This was truly chilling. The men standing beside the truck, Steiner and Amin, both armed with AKs and continued to fire single shots from their rifles whenever they saw movement. And before the butchers laid the largest pile of corpses yet, at least 2 dozen dead or dying human beings cut to shreds by high-velocity bullets. I looked down at the bodies and soon discovered something horrifying. The dead were not military-aged men. They were women, children, and old people. I guessed the militia had kidnapped them from one of the local villages, bringing the innocent people here for the purpose of mass murder. I felt physically sick as I stared in disbelief at the pile of fresh corpses. Yet another moral line had been passed. We'd killed men before, but at least they were enemy fighters who would have done the same to us given the chance. But these were innocent civilians who posed no threat. Why had my comrades done this? I soon got my answer. Our employer arrived right on cue, his luxurious car driving up the dirt track, parking in the mud, while 2 black-suited bodyguards jumped out, securing the perimeter before opening the door for our mutual employer. The tyrant was positively giddy as his boots trudged through the mud, and I noted the almost childlike grin on his lips as his dark eyes lit up with a sickening excitement. He confidently marched over to the bodies, removing his ivory stick, which he promptly used to poke the corpses, inspecting them like they were slabs of beef. "Ah, excellent!" the tyrant exclaimed enthusiastically. "This sacrifice of pure blood will please Diablo greatly. We will enjoy many weeks of success on the battlefield." My jaw dropped and I could contain myself no longer. "You bloody murderer," I screamed. "What the hell have you done?" The tyrant shot me a look that could kill, his expression turning from jubilation to fury in a split second. Once again, I feared his temper would get the better of him, but the tyrant regained some level of composure, spitting out a barely concealed threat as he continued to glare right through me. "You would do well to hold your tongue, soldier," he snarled. "Remember your place." "The hell I will," I shot back in defiance. "You're not going to feed those people to the croc. It's a goddamn abomination." I raised my rifle and prepared to aim, but before I could do so, I felt cold steel pressed against my neck and a chilling voice in my ears. "Drop it, or I'll slit your throat." It was Ease, one of the trackers who remained loyal to his tyrant. I froze for a second as I considered my next move. I wanted to kill them all, but in the end, there was nothing I could do. I knew Ease would follow through on his threat without hesitation, so I dropped my rifle in the mud and held my hands up. Kato quickly approached me from my left-hand side, and the 2 men held me tightly as I struggled in vain against their tight grip. The tyrant smiled sadistically before he spoke his next chilling words. "I shall deal with you later," he warned. "Now, let us begin the ritual." I continued to struggle as Jan and Steiner stepped forward, slowly walking toward the bodies, which surely now would need to be fed to the beast. It was only then that I noticed something wasn't right. Normally, Diablo knew when he was about to be fed and would get excited, splashing through the water in eager anticipation as he prepared to devour his offerings. But not on this occasion. It was deadly silent for a moment, until the two mercenaries put their hands on the first body. That was when all hell broke loose. Suddenly, we all heard a deep, guttural roar coming from the bottom of the watery pit as Diablo made his presence known. The reptile's bellowing was so loud that it drowned out every other sound and everybody froze, including the tyrant, whose eyes filled with terror for the first time. But there was far more power to the sound than a simple predator's roar. An ancient dark magic was invoked in that moment, and the terrifying implications soon became apparent. I saw the first body twitching and thought it was just post-mortem spasm. But then the corpse of a young girl sluggishly stood up upon her shaking feet. Half of her head had been shot off, and there was no chance she could have survived. And yet the girl was able to stand and walk. And my blood froze when I looked into her dead eyes and saw the twisted smile on her bloody lips. This girl wasn't human, not anymore. She was the first to rise, but others soon followed, as a small army of the undead came back to the mortal realm after hearing the beast's roar. Jan and Steiner stood closest to the resurrected corpses, and so became their first victims. Both mercenaries were initially frozen at witnessing the unnatural sight, but their combat instincts kicked in once they saw the imminent threat. Both reached for their guns, but the zombies were on top of them before any shots were fired, clawing at their flesh and eyes and biting into their throats. The men screamed as the animalistic attack intensified. They fought back desperately, but their struggle was futile, as the undead soon overwhelmed their victims. But they didn't devour the men's flesh. This privilege was reserved for their master. I could only stand and watch as the zombies pulled the still-living mercenaries over to the side of the pit before throwing them over the edge. I heard the men's screams as their bodies hit the water with two heavy splashes, and a moment later followed the sickening sound of Diablo biting into flesh, delivering his trademark death roll as he quickly dispatched one and then two of his victims. Pandemonium broke out in the next few moments. The two trackers, Ease and Cato, let go of me and fled toward the forest in a blind panic. They surely knew what was coming and didn't wish to hang around for the bloody aftermath. Amin, the third mercenary, soon followed suit, dropping his rifle as he sprinted toward the perimeter. I frantically glanced toward my employer and saw the shock in his eyes. Out of some kind of misdirected loyalty, his bodyguards did attempt to protect their boss, drawing their pistols and opening fire upon the advancing zombies as they launched their attack. But the bullets didn't stop the horde, and the zombies barely reacted as the rounds tore through their already dead flesh. In an instant, the zombies descended upon the pair of bodyguards, knocking the guns from their hands before they proceeded to bash the men's brains in with their fists and feet. Only then did my employer react, as he desperately tried to flee back toward the car. But the driver wasn't waiting, as he put his foot down on the accelerator and sped down the mud path toward the perimeter gate. The tyrant ran after the car for a short time, screaming obscenities and threats before tripping and falling into the dirt. The horde was hot on his tail, descending upon the screaming warlord as he squirmed in the mud, crying out in terror and pathetically attempting to defend himself with his ivory stick. The horde soon subdued him, however, beating the tyrant bloody and removing all his power as they dragged him, still kicking and screaming, toward the pit's edge. I listened to my soon-to-be ex-employer's desperate pleas in his final moments as he screamed, "No! You can't do this! We had a deal!" But of course his words fell on deaf ears as the brainwashed zombies pulled him to the edge and unceremoniously shoved him down the steep slope. I don't know why I stayed. The undead hadn't assaulted me for whatever reason, but that didn't mean I wasn't in danger. Nevertheless, I didn't flee from the bloody scene just yet, and instead I had a twisted urge to walk to the pit's edge and look down. I'll confess to experiencing a grim satisfaction as I watched the tyrant thrashing in the already bloody water, his eyes wide with terror as he faced the terrible consequences of his heinous actions. Diablo took his time with his final prey, slowly ascending to the surface, his slick, scaled body cutting through the crimson waters before he bit deep into the flailing warlord and dragged him under the surface, drowning the entirely helpless man before tearing his body in two, filling the already polluted water with yet more blood and viscera. In his next move, Diablo rammed the dam, separating the watery pit from the river beyond, easily smashing his way through and swimming out into the waterway. This proved that the deity, like Reptile, had not truly been imprisoned. Diablo was never under the warlord's control. He'd been using the tyrant for his own purposes, waiting for the opportunity to deliver the killer blow. I looked on as the predator slowly swam with the current of the river, although I turned around sharply when I heard a noise behind me. Swinging around, I saw the first of the zombies collapse into the mud, closely followed by a second, then a third. Within seconds, all the undead fell down in the mud, never to move again. Their purpose had been fulfilled, and, thanks to Diablo, they gained revenge against their murderers. And now these poor souls could finally rest in peace. I didn't hang around for long, grabbing my gun and all the supplies I could carry before escaping from the camp on foot, because I knew I wouldn't survive on the roads. Hacking through the thick forest and brush, I had to survive the harsh environment, avoiding the dangerous wildlife and the various hostile militias which stalked the land. But what scared me most was the curse of Diablo. Horrifying images of the beast haunted my dreams, and every time I approached the body of water, I experienced a cold primal terror, expecting the huge reptile to emerge and devour me in his mighty jaws. Somehow, I made it to the coast, staggering half-dead into a Red Cross facility, where I was slowly nursed back to health. I gave the aid workers a false name and backstory, not wanting to reveal the extent of my war crimes. And after the doctors patched me up, I took the first flight out of Africa, never to return. Many won't believe my story or will think I've invented this tale of a supernatural killer crocodile to cover up my own sins. I don't know why he let me go. Perhaps because I tried to stop the final massacre. Or maybe Diablo let me live so I could spread his legend to a new generation. I'm under no illusions, however. I will surely pay the price for my many crimes, either in this life or the next. And in the end, I won't be surprised if I end up in Diablo's hellish jaws. I hope you enjoyed Diablo the Maneater by Finn McCool, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, well, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Finn-McCool. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/FINN-MCCOOL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. I suppose he's lucky that he didn't bite off more than he could chew, eh? Sure, his fate is still up in the air, but suddenly, getting a little moral clarity can sometimes stave off much worse things. Like that time I didn't do anything about those police officers that were checking my lawn. I mean, after all, I certainly didn't want them anywhere near the tool shed. Sometimes it's not quite so obvious that you're somewhere you should have never gone. I mean, you get invited to a hip happening party with all the most elite gaggle of guests in town. You just wouldn't expect anything weirder than the dress code or the catering. But no, this party, thrown by a Mr. Dale Thompson, is a little different, with a special guest that can't help but introduce itself personally to everyone there. And that guest isn't interested in the cheese tray. Without further ado, I present to you A Party to Die For. Perhaps the most oddball thing about this story is it's only true in some circles, mainly orbiting around a kooky, enigmatic planet in a timeless, encapsulated cosmos yet to be explored and plumbed. Within the unfathomable, outlandish, swirling, untested alchemy, someone decided to invite the outcasts, the throwaways, the misfits, you know, the artsy type, to a party. They were not necessarily malcontent, and I'll tell you why. They were not purposely rebellious for the sake of anarchy, nor egomaniacs. As a matter of fact, many hid their self-loathing behind a mask identifying as outcasts, although there may have been a prima donna or two within the group. Pariahs or not, they were their own community, knit as tightly as a weaver's bridge, but with suppressed prejudice, underlying jealousy, and hypocritical mutuality, fearful of being utterly embraced or sung by anyone. The song remained the same, muted until this night when the genie was let out of the bottle like an avalanche of melodic notes too hard to grasp. The idiosyncrasies on this night would be threatening and murderous. No one was surprised because, in agreement, they drank the poison and embraced the duality of life and death, calling it the only pill left to swallow. Enough is never enough, and to quote the Arabian Nights Entertainment, the more one has, the more one wants. This could mean fame, wealth, or amenities of various sorts. Before I'm able to continue the story, I have to explain something integral to the plot. I'm about to speak about darkness. Within the vast universe, or this confined casual party, there was an intimacy which did not stray from flirting with disaster, and darkness was all around. Looking into the auriferous cavities of darkness, it was impossible to see the idling soul and how madness occupied the place where moral sense would be found. Only when darkness returned the gaze did one know they were looking into their own demise. Within the fathomless dark eyes, atrocious traps and snares were laid. But darkness could play the game, but without the rules, as it became the antithesis, grooming itself between good and evil in an Ouroboros fashion. Moreover, its eccentricity could not be considered anything other than strange. Some have found darkness to be an annoyance because no one could say when darkness was given birth. When did darkness cause blindness to the rich and poor? When did cosmos vortices begin to swirl? No one can say. Darkness is a god unto itself, feeding off fear, replacing the light. The shards and shadows huddle just outside of the circle of life, holding the mind hostage. As the default of the universe, there is darkness existing where no light is ever sullied. One cannot conceive the time when darkness encountered its first wandering soul, nor how, after that confrontation, the darkness expanded on alien modes within the malleable cloak of storms stemming from corporal and opaque curtains of inclemency that thereafter raged. The party was being held in a rather upscale apartment right smack dab in the center of the city on what should have been called the 13th floor, yet curiously it was named the 14th floor. The host was Constance, a 40-something-year-old woman with a striking face and unreadable smile who owned a remarkable Bombay black cat. The cat was infectious for some, unreserved, proving to be a social butterfly, playfully greeting each guest with a figure eight between the legs, around the ankles, purring and nuzzling without exception. Constance had been divorced twice and was now living off of a small inheritance and wealth gotten from divorce. This influx of unearned finances made her financially secure and afforded her the opportunity to host such gatherings. Constance needed to be seen once in a while for her own sanity. The first guests to arrive were art critic Larissa and her male companion Eric, whom she had never introduced before. They were dressed alike and could be adolescent twins in stiff, dull dress suits with unsightly wide vertical black and white stripes.
They were connoisseurs and epicures,
purported not to be a couple, but he clung to her like a baby chimpanzee. The next guests welcomed in were a lesbian couple, Tasman and Venetia. The pair had multifloral colored hair, and in a paradoxical attachment, they were now speaking with fake English accents. This is called the Madonna syndrome, after the singer Madonna, whose accent changed throughout the years according to which era one would discover her. They were a physical convergence of similitude, but would rest fundamentally inverse of one another. The couple were known in the art community more as enthusiasts, and some would say sybarites, because they could be found somewhere each night hobnobbing with the rich, the famous, or the gifted nymphed types. With extravagance, the ever-so-taciturn Kiyomi, a young, bald African-American, made her presence known in muted egress. Kiyomi was a known chef at a very popular restaurant in the city, and all of the guests would have eaten dishes that she had prepared before. She made her way into the corner where Tasman was handing Venetia a drink from the bar, where Constance was happily taking orders. Marlene was the next to arrive with a young woman who she introduced as Cordelia, her apprentice. Marlene was heavily influenced by the macabre and prided herself as one known to be drawn to occult studies. She was always ruminating, heavy in thought, and appeared to become offended if someone addressed her unexpectedly. Marlene was dressed in black as one that would be in mourning for a dear friend, yet this was simply her fashion. Marlene seemed to be incumbent upon her apprentice to serve her, as a professional aide might. Cordelia was given a stipend in money for this association, so she could hardly complain. Others arrived shortly thereafter, which made the spacious apartment a little cozier as the bodies slid in. All in all, Constance had invited about 15 people, and it appeared no one had declined the invitation. Larissa whispered to Eric with parted lips as if she was performing a ventriloquist routine, but he could barely hear. "Can you believe how unsentimental Kiyomi has become?" Eric looked Kiyomi up and down. Ever since she got that head job as a chef and more authority, she believes her self-importance in the restaurant somehow translates outside the kitchen. Eric sat cross-legged, hunched over with an elbow on the knee. The Bombay cat had snuck up on the pair, and Larissa looked down with distaste. "Does everybody have a furball other than myself?" Eric pushed the cat away, saying, "They're like shedding machines." Constance observed the pushing away of the cat, and she left her bar duties to address Eric. Smiling diffidently, she asked Eric, "Was the little fur baby bothering you? I'm so sorry. She's a glutton for affection." "Indeed, she is. I have some mild allergies to indoor pets," Eric lied. Constance smiled cutely, scooped up the cat, and moved her away politely. She was never this jovial. Did she not have an introverted personality? Larissa remarked, making sure that she kept the volume of her voice under the radar. Eric scoffed and replied, "If I were to conjecture or surmise, I would diagnose her as being on the spectrum." "Oh, Eric, you're so funny." "Cruel, but funny," Larissa said. The house smelled of secrets. Putrid miasma thickened among the guests as conversations grouped in the corners of the rooms. All attention was drawn to Kiyomi as she burst into unaccountable enthusiasm. "Oh, she must have won the raffle," Eric demeaned her because he assumed he and his huddled minions had been left out. "Do not let it rot your brain, Eric, my dear. Remember, she's only a cook in a kitchen with a simple mind. She would find anything amusing under the right circumstances." Larissa produced a vanilla vape pipe and inhaled. The Bombay cat was now being held by Constance, who was rubbing it as it purred contently. Tasman and her partner, Venetia, called out to Constance. They were sitting two to a single chair and wanted to see the cat. "What a lovely kitty," Venetia remarked, wanting to stroke the cat, yet she hesitated. "Does she like strangers?" Tasman asked. "Oh, she loves everybody. Constance decorously said. The girls both reached out to give the cat a pat. The cat lifted its chin and purred like a motor. "What's her name?" Venetia asked, completely hypnotized by the feline. "Her name is Darkness," Constance answered. "Darkness? That's a bold name. How did you arrive at that name?" Tasman was intrigued. "She's always been Darkness. Came to me already named. I did not name her, but since she's solid black, I could not think of a more befitting name," said Constance. "Yes, I'd have to agree. I do not believe I've ever seen a cat with such perfect, unblemished fur before," Venetia noticed. Meanwhile, Marlene and Cordelia, sitting across the room, had not stopped staring at Darkness, who was beginning to fidget, so Constance placed the cat on the floor. The cat darted around the corner and disappeared. "Did you see how suspiciously that cat was behaving?" Marlene asked. Cordelia hung on Marlene's observation. "I feel as estranged as Judas. Something is odd with that cat," Marlene said. Cordelia mused. "Cats are spooky weird anyway, especially black cats. I've never been a cat person, and now that I think about it, I do not remember a time when I considered wanting a dog either." "The same. Too much unnecessary responsibility, if you ask me," Marlene stated as fact. Music was coming through the entertainment center, and it was not feasible to whisper any longer. Marlene gave Cordelia a glance as if to say not to speak too loudly. Calvin Childers, an art collector and amateur filmmaker, had stood from the soft sofa where he'd been sitting with a group of like-minded creative types to stretch his legs. Because his perusal of his friends was complete, and the greater need was the toilet. Abnormally limping because his left leg had fallen asleep, he threaded through the guests. Some were now in dance mode, and he found the hallway that would lead him to relief. As he entered the hallway, the noise in the former room quickly became dull to his ears, as if someone had turned the volume down. He questioned himself if he needed to head back and investigate how the music had all but faded into nothingness, but he had committed to the hallway and kept going straight. He thought he was the only person in the hallway. It was narrow but ample enough for two people who might meet to pass one another cleanly. Unexpectedly, his attention was drawn to a figure standing where he assumed the toilet area was. Calvin, who was above average in height, noticed that the figure was a head taller than he was and was blurred due to the yellow hue of the light. He didn't know why he felt threatened. He stopped, and in a remonstrance with only the intention of showing authority, he addressed the unknown guest. "I've had too much to drink. I need to get in there." The form in the hallway took a step back as if to concede, but no words were exchanged. Calvin moved closer, and to his shock, this figure standing on the other side of the doorway leading into the bathroom was no man nor a woman. Rather, this entity was an enormous, hairy, horrid, impalpable simulacrum that was indefinable. There was no scream, no call for help, no struggle. Calvin experienced a brief moment of abject terror and then was simply gone. All that remained were traces of blood on the floor and blood spatter up the walls extending to the ceiling where specks of red clung. It was evidence of something diabolical. But with no body, nothing could be proven. It was as if he had been swallowed up alive by that which is indissolubly evil. Back in the main party room, no one was even aware that Calvin had left to visit the bathroom, so no one was the wiser, which meant there was no concern and no hunt to locate this irrecoverable partygoer. Darkness, the Bombay cat, had emerged from the shadows and had joined the others again, and she happily made her rounds, visiting with each group. Hardly anyone was mingling outside of their human pods, except to possibly bump into one another at the bar, as Constance gladly poured more drinks for her guests. Larissa and Eric had not moved from their perch and were still having a private go at anyone they deemed unworthy of their approval. "Oh, she's infantile. Just look at how she postures herself. Larissa was speaking about Kiyomi still, whom she had taken a disliking to, having only just met her recently at another party. She's young and rude and lewd, laughed Eric. I find most young people inexorably uncouth, unable to change until they get some mileage on them, and have gone through the dramas and tragedies that we all have to suffer through to reach adulthood. There's a price to be paid for maturity, Larissa said once again, inhaling the vanilla vape and fogging her side of the room up with the smoke. The two of them had sat for so long they were inert when they attempted to raise from their laid-back seats. Eric had to give Larissa a hand and dragged her up clumsily, for Eric was a 90-pound weakling. That was a mission, Larissa said. I know where the toilet is. Follow me, Eric said. They danced their way awkwardly, stiff-legged, and with knotted lower backs across the invented dance floor. Together, they started down the hallway, both in desperate need of the toilet. You go first. I might pee on the seat. Eric laughed vulgarly. I will not argue with you. I really need to go, Larissa said as she pressed her thighs together and shuffled into the bathroom. Eric stood waiting his turn. He'd drunk several drinks and was a little unbalanced because of this state of intoxication. The noise that he heard after Larissa closed the door caused him a stunted reaction. He delayed so unfavorably that by the time his perennial fear had observed the venerable assault of something far greater and ancient than he could identify, only then did he realize that his head was inside of something darker than the Stygian cloud-covered sky. Without an extended tribulation, Eric was engulfed by that which feeds on flesh, and he was gone from his watch by the door. Larissa finally emerged and never noticed any imminent danger lurking, only a few feet away in the dark shadows. She would have normally been livid that Eric had left her without saying a word, or even knocking on the door, but because she placed her hand on the door casing and felt something wet and sticky, she could see clearly from the bathroom light that it was blood. The first thought was not poor Eric. What happened to poor Eric? Her first impression was, how gross is this? And she hoped that she was not contaminated with the diseased blood. She returned to the toilet and washed her hands with soap and hot water thoroughly. It practically made her sick, but the illness that came next was the interminable fear that seized her unaware. Something eventually clicked in her mind and she realized something horrible had happened. She did not feel a great shame in being scared, but she did slam the door shut and lock it. She paced the bathroom floor, soliloquizing, wondering what she could do. She had never been described as a nervous person, but she had never been this disjointed mentally before either. She could hear something moving and brushing along the walls of the hallway. It was as if a large animal was breathing obnoxiously against the door. Moving closer to the door with complete caution, she slowly reached out and barely touched the frame with her fingertips. Whatever was on the other side must have sensed her movement, because a violent raking sound was heard, like multiple knives being dragged across a wooden table. Frightened beyond human possibility, she recoiled in a defensive posture, but she had no weapon with which to defend herself. She dug in her handbag for her cell phone. Instead of dialing emergency services, she found the number Constance had given out when inviting guests to the party. It rang once, twice, and before the third ring, Constance's voice answered. Hello? With a quivering voice and hand shaking, Larissa whispered into the phone. I need help. I'm sorry, we're having a party and the music's loud. Can you speak a little louder, please? Constance, it's me, Larissa. Help me, I'm trapped in your bathroom. There's something outside of the door. Larissa, is that you? Constance sounded genuinely surprised. Yes, help me. I am amazed, Larissa. Constance had an air of uncertainty to her tone. Amazed at what? I'm here, in deep trouble, and Eric's gone, she replied. I'm amazed you're able to phone me. Darkness usually does not play with her food this long. There was a purring outside the door that sounded like a kitten. There was a tramp and patter of scurrying feet back and forth, as if the cat was chasing something up and down the hallway. The phone call disconnected. "It's just a little cat, that's all," Larissa convinced herself. "It's a joke, a game." "Not funny," she said as she rested her hand on the doorknob. Her inexplicable trepidation was like a yoke around her thin neck. "I must be brave. I must be vigilant," as she watched with unblinking awareness. Her hand turned the doorknob. When she opened the door, it opened to a carnal pollutant of decay, and she cried out in dread and regret that she trusted her intuition. On any other occasion, she would have made the correct choice, but when she realized that the lights were no longer yellow in the hallway, but had turned a saffron glow, she realized that it was actually her blood changing the ambient color. With a splinter of a moment, she was hungrily ingested whole, leather purse, Prada shoes and all. Marlene, the occultist, and her callow protege, Cordelia, had been content, sitting idle, observing the room carefully. "There's a dark spirit here tonight. I don't like it," Marlene stated. "The probabilities for something hideous are ripe." "There's too much booze and drugs for my liking," Cordelia said. "I think it's more wicked than that. This room feels like it's heavy with adamantine chains upon it, and every set of lips has become putrescent with suspicion." Marlene stood to get some blood flow to her lower body. "Do you want to leave?" Cordelia asked. "Not sure. We're not dealing with necromancy or paranormal activities here. This is something tangible. I can sense it. I just do not know what it is," Marlene said. She eyed the room, taking mental notes, and then she realized as something bleak deep inside her chilled her coldly with a painful winteriness. "Looks like we're missing some guests." "Who?" Cordelia asked. With keen austerity, Marlene answered, "I no longer see that scarcely visible revulsion of a man, Calvin Childers. I saw him head toward the bathroom earlier, but he never emerged. And likewise, those tumultuous art critics, the pugnacious Larissa and her sidekick Eric, the flamboyant, they also went that direction without returning." Just at that moment, Constance came seemingly out of nowhere, holding Darkness gently in her arms. "How are you enjoying the party?" "I've been to less intolerable parties in my day. Too bad the weather was not nice enough to be outdoors," Marlene answered in her usual, disordered way. "I'm going to bring out some finger food, if anyone's hungry," Constance informed the pair. "After all of this alcohol, I'd be surprised if anyone's digestion can handle food. The malaise of spirits ingested already could sink a ship. The finger foods should have been earlier, my love, but if you have a sausage on a stick, I would happily devour one," Marlene said credulously, as if the film of a movie production was rolling. "Excellent," Constance said as Darkness licked its lips and purred happily. Although upbeat music was playing and people were dancing, uninhibited and drinking, observantly, Marlene felt the weight of Paul over the apartment and she feared it might soon spread into the guests as well. The consumption of spirits had been a free-flowing delight, and some people were chilling out while others, intoxicated, were raising their voices unnecessarily. Marlene was completely done with the intolerable childishness around her and this disquieting, unseen force she felt. She told Cordelia not to have anything else to drink and to sober up as quickly as possible. Constance emerged from the kitchen with her hospitality face alight and dispersed trays of assorted bread, cheeses, and dips to the guests. Tasman and Venetia were more than ready to enjoy a bite. They'd been the two main dancers of the night, showing off their moves, and had worked up quite the appetite. Arlene asked Tasman quietly, "Have you been paying attention to what has been going on tonight, or have you been too busy getting your groove thing on?" The question sounded rude and somewhat harsh, but Tasman knew of Marlene's deprecating mannerisms and oftentimes stalwart approach to conversation. "Thank you for noticing our moments on the dance floor, but no, I've come to have a good time. Not to analyze the room for ghosts and shadows either, she answered. Your indefinable dance routine may have been replaced by indefinable fear soon. I'm only giving you fair warning. Something is broadly off tonight, Marlene said. You didn't check your crystal ball before coming tonight? I thought it was imperative for those dabbling in the dark arts to do so before venturing out. If you'd done so, then you would have avoided the party altogether, Desmond said. No, I would have attended nevertheless. I'm a woman of indomitable spirit, thus I'm right where I need to be, Marlene confidently boasted. It was at that point Mitchell Wilson, who boasted himself as a one-man acting troupe, who had put on a couple of unsuccessful shows in his day, stumbled, obviously inebriated, up to Marlene. As obnoxious as he smelled, Marlene didn't want to be rude or unkind to such a pathetic creature, so she obliged his attention and asked, "Mitchell, long time no see. I hope you're well." With slurred viscosity of words and visibly panting as a man in the early stages of emphysema, Mitchell laughed and dismally announced, "I am not having a very good time tonight." "It's because you're swimming in your own decay," Marlena laughed back. "Listen, are you a witchy person, right? You feel things, see dead people and whatnot, right?" Marlene didn't answer. She simply looked into his old, watery eyes with sadness. He tried to enthrall her. "Tell me something. Do you have any utterly brilliant spells for my love life? Or am I simply cursed under these omens for something I have done wrong or maybe not done right? I fear that I'm trapped in the inclemencies of frigid subterranean existence." Marlene did not like this distraction, but she didn't see any reason to make his night worse, so she improvised an answer to suffice him. "Mitchell, I'm getting the sense of a man with immeasurable talent with untapped significant potential, who needs not ride the waves of emotion or the coattails of others. Dream on. Sober up. Take a shower. Tomorrow's your day, notwithstanding if you survive the night. I suggest the cheese and crackers," she advised, and then, taking Cordelia by the hand, she went to the water jug to quench her thirst and get some food in her system. Colluding together, Marlene with Cordelia trailing right on her heels, set themselves up in an unoccupied corner so they had a clear view of the room along with the hallway. Meanwhile, as they sat with an entire tray of savories in front of them, drinking only water now, darkness surprised them by laying at their feet and rolling around, stretching playfully for attention. Cordelia revisited the earlier conversation. "Where do you think the others went off to?" "That's what I'm trying to surmise. The peculiarities seem to be immense. I'm also missing a couple of others I saw earlier tonight, and now they're nowhere at all. I haven't seen anyone leave through the front door, that much I'm sure of," Marlene stated. Darkness suddenly leapt up onto its paws, as cats unpredictably do, and jetted from the room into the dimly lit hallway. Marlene noticed Mitchell stumbling along and heading in the same direction the darkness had gone. Obviously, Mitchell was desperate for a toilet. Believing that Mitchell may be headed into precariously undesirable consequences, Marlene suggested they follow him to the restroom so that he returned on his own accord. As soon as they entered the hallway together, both were abnormally quickened by an unexplained, grievous fear, intensified by the uncomfortable feeling of being watched. The dreadful vividness that ensued only served to intensify the unmanageable, grievous fear, and neither could explain the acute monstrosities of pervade doom and gloom. "This is weird," Cordelia said, her youthful eyes wide open. "I don't like this. Where'd he go?" Marlene could not figure out how Mitchell, who could barely walk on his own, simply disappeared and was gone, vanished from the hallway without a trace. "Maybe ducked into one of these rooms by mistake," Cordelia offered. "Maybe." She tried the first door, but it was locked. Together, they tried a couple more doors on their way to the bathroom, but the doors were all locked. Maybe he's faster than he looks, Cordelia said. Oh, that's very doubtful, Marlene said as she began to turn her horn amulet around her neck. She always wore a protection charm. The red horn amulet derived from the cornucopia, which was originally a goat horn filled with gold and precious stones to ward off the evil eye. She twisted it with her fingers, hoping it was powerful enough to protect them. Some party, huh? Cordelia dismally said. This one's on my list of ones to avoid in the future, Marlene swore. The two came to the toilet without seeing a single soul, but they did immediately see the bloodbath on the walls, floor, and ceiling, and then their attention was drawn to the door with its horrific deep grooves which had been scratched into the wood. My God, what could have done this? Cordelia asked. We need Almighty God for this. This is despicable bad magic, the type that will incapacitate even the best of good magic. Blood with no bodies. Where are the bodies? Something cold touched Marlena's imagination vividly, like premonition, and she shuddered from the implanted thoughts. Run! Go! 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 She pushed Cordelia back up the hallway toward the party in a hurried rush. Perilous mesmerisms flashed like light bulbs exploding in their minds, never actually exposing the true scene. It was inadvisable to give in to this incoherent phenomenon. The snapshot vision showed appurtenances within a room of untold horrors, cauldrons of black sludge, white bleached human skulls, and devilish sacrilegious absurdities. The vision, beyond the focus of common man, would not let loose of them. The hallway was infinitely longer than they remembered. Undeterred by the inconvenience and unknown probabilities, they sprinted soberly and swiftly from an abhorrence of infernal illusion they had not even seen. But the blood, the volumes of blood that they saw, only had one explanation. Murder. Extraordinarily cheerless, cold-blooded, unspeakable murder. The two ran back into the thumping sounds of the party, but there was not a single soul dancing. There was an empty room with only Constance sitting in a lounge chair, holding Darkness on her lap. Less than ecstatic, Darkness was curled up, behaved, but had her head raised. Constance used the remote and killed the tumultuous music. The instant silence made the room feel much smaller than it was. Your cat. Your cat has done something devious, Cordelia accused. Do you mean this adorable, unequaled beast? Constance asked as Darkness began licking its paws clean. Then the cat purred with an amplification in a tone no different than the sound of an augury of death. What's going on here, Constance? What do you want? Marlene unsympathetically asked. Marlene, in her time, had delved in some darker things herself, but murder was not something she had ever considered. Something is wrong in this house, very wrong, Cordelia said, staring directly into Darkness's eyes. Be it as it may, there's something wrong in the world in general. But you do not see Darkness and I making wild accusations. We had a party. You were invited. You attended. You did not enjoy yourselves, and that makes us sad, Constance said as a reminder. What happened to Calvin and the others? Cordelia asked. Constance smiled sardonically and then quoted a Bible verse. It is appointed once for a man to die, then there is judgment. Stop talking nonsense and tell us what you want, Marlene continued with a twist of her horn charm around her neck, wishing it possessed the power of decimation. But respectively, it was a mere charm of inconsequential substance. Knowing it not to be true, Constance said insatiably, Very good, very good. Your amulet is powerful. Darkness hissed at Marlene with a sibilant disgust. It brought the women a chill of uneasy feelings. You see, Darkness entered my life unannounced like a treasure, and in no time I became her apprentice or apprentice. I thought at first I had a new pet, but then when she insistently opened up to me, I guess roles changed, and now I serve Darkness. Arlene could not believe what she was hearing. Darkness glared fiendishly at her, but deep down, She believed and hoped that the amulet she wore had saved her and Cordelia. Her flesh still prickled with cold at the inflection of the purring. "You're angry because you cannot stop us from leaving," Marlene boldly assumed. "You are very exacting, and that's the reason you are free to leave. Your amulet is a nice party favor, but it possesses no magic. Darkness is no longer hungry, so I would suggest that we do not meet again under any circumstances, else you may find that your fate will be like others when darkness is hungry," Constance advised garishly. Marlene and Cordelia began to edge their way to the door. Their nerves on edge, their hearts were racing, but easing with each step. When they reached the door, they turned away from Constance and darkness, but when they pulled the door, it would not open. Marlene gave it a hard jerk once, twice, but the door was firmly shut. Constance laughed faintly. "Now the story is finished, and you might ask, how is it that I know so much about what happened at that party?" "Trust be known, I am darkness." I hope you enjoyed A Party to Die For by Dale Thompson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, well, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author, as well as all of our authors who provided us with tales tonight. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs. Or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. And you can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky. And get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?